Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine going to the doctor with a cluster of really severe, baffling autoimmune symptoms.
Yeah, the kind where your body is essentially attacking itself and nobody knows why.
Exactly. So they sequence your DNA and they find a typo in your genetic code. But the result comes back with this incredibly frustrating label, a variant of uncertain significance.
Which basically means you are stuck in diagnostic limbo.
Right. What really happens when a doctor has to wait years to figure out if your specific genetic mutation is harmless, or if it's actually the dangerous culprit behind your illness?
It's an awful situation for a patient.
It really is. But how could this change if we already knew the answer before you even walked into the clinic?
That is the ultimate goal, right? Because right now, when a patient presents with a variant that medical science just, you know, hasn't seen enough times to classify, the standard clinical pathway just grinds to a halt.
Today we celebrate the work of Anna Aksakova, Amund H. Berger, Frederick P. Roth, and their international team of researchers from the University of Toronto, Sinai Health, and the University of Bergen, who have advanced our understanding of how to proactively interpret genetic variants.
It's a really incredible piece of work.
We are unpacking their 2026 paper from the American Journal of Human Genetics. The mission of this deep dive is to explore how this team basically bypassed that reactive bottleneck entirely by mapping out thousands of genetic variants to solve clinical mysteries proactively.
Yeah, they stopped waiting for patients to get sick with the exact same mutation.
Right. And to understand the mechanism they used, we first have to look at the gene at the center of this study, which is AIR, spelled A-I-R-E, which stands for autoimmune regulator.
Yeah, AIRE sits at the very foundation of human immune tolerance.
Which is super important.
Oh, absolutely. Its primary staging ground is the thymus, specifically within these cells called medullary thymic epithelial cells, or MTECs.
Okay, MTECs.
Right, so when your T cells are maturing in the thymus, they need to be calibrated. T cells are essentially, well, they're lethal weapons designed to attack non-self antigens, like viruses.
So the biological problem is ensuring they don't attack our own endogenous tissue, right?
Exactly. And AIR facilitates this by driving the expression of thousands of tissue-restricted antigens. These are proteins that normally only exist in specific organs, like, say, the retina or the pancreas.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this, AIR acts like a security training simulator for the immune system.
I love that analogy, yes.
It runs this massive simulation in the thymus, forcing those epithelial cells to show the developing T cells what normal everyday proteins look like.
Precisely, and if a developing T cell binds too strongly to one of those self proteins in the simulator, it triggers apoptosis.
So the rogue cell is destroyed before it can enter the peripheral bloodstream and cause havoc.
Right, but the clinical consequences when that simulator fails are profound. If the AIR gene carries a loss of function mutation, self-reactive T cells basically escape the thymus.
Which leads directly to autoimmune polyendocrine syndrome type 1, or APS1.
Yeah, APS1. It's an exceptionally rare monogenic disorder. It affects like less than 1 in 100,000 people globally.
Though I know the prevalence spikes in certain isolated populations due to founder effects, I think it's about 1 in 25,000 in Finland, and it's quite prevalent in Sardinian populations as well.
Yeah, that's right. And these patients experience a cascading autoimmune assault. They classically present with a triad of symptoms: hypoparathyroidism, primary adrenal insufficiency, and chronic mucocutaneous candidiasis, which is a severe chronic yeast infection.
And catching that early is critical for managing the endocrinopathy.
It's a matter of life and death, frankly.
But when we look at the ClinVar database today, something like 81% of AIR missense variants are classified as variants of uncertain significance.
Yeah, 81%. It's staggering.
I mean, if a patient has a massive structural deletion, the diagnosis is straightforward. But if they just have a single nucleotide swap resulting in a missense mutation, clinicians are left guessing.
And historically, resolving those VUSs requires custom, low-throughput functional assays.
Meaning you have to do them one by one.
Exactly. You have to synthesize that specific variant, express it in a cell line, and measure its functional output. Doing that one variant at a time, retroactively, it simply cannot scale to meet the demands of modern clinical sequencing.
So this research team set out to build a comprehensive variant effect map.
Right.
They moved from reactive testing to proactive mapping by evaluating nearly every possible missense mutation in the AIR gene simultaneously.
It's a huge undertaking.
How do they actually do it? I know they utilized human HEK293 cells for this, engineering them with a reporter system.
Yeah, so they tied an insulin promoter to a green fluorescent protein reporter, or GFP.
Okay, so if the R protein functions correctly, it binds, activates the promoter, and the cell fluoresces green.
You got it. And if the variant breaks the protein, the cell remains dark.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Why specifically use an insulin promoter to test a broad autoimmune regulator? Considering APS1 involves the parathyroid and adrenal glands, doesn't relying on an insulin proxy risk missing the broader functional picture?
That is a great question. The selection of the insulin promoter is actually highly strategic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, AIR regulates thousands of genes, but insulin is one of the most vigorously upregulated tissue-restricted antigens in the thymus.
I see.
More importantly, from a clinical perspective, autoantibodies against insulin are a primary trigger for type 1 diabetes, which is a major devastating component of the APS1 clinical phenotype.
Ah, okay. That makes a lot of sense.
So by measuring the activation of the insulin promoter, the researchers are looking at a highly validated, biologically relevant proxy. If a mutation prevents AIR from driving insulin expression in this assay, it's highly predictive of an inability to drive complex immune tolerance in vivo.
Got it. So with the reporter system in place, the challenge scales up. How do you actually generate nearly 10,000 specific missense mutations and get them into these cells without introducing, you know, massive synthesis bias or background noise?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. The team utilized a mutagenesis framework called DTPOP code.
DTPOP code, which stands for Dual Tag Precision Oligo Pool Based Code Alteration.
Exactly. So instead of error-prone PCR methods that generate sort of random mutations, they used microarray technology to synthesize massive pools of oligonucleotides.
So they are building them from scratch.
Right. Each oligo is programmed to carry one specific amino acid substitution. And the dual tag aspect is the critical innovation here.
How does that work?
By appending specific barcode tags to the mutant oligos, they can rigorously filter out the inevitable synthesis errors that occur on microarrays.
Ooh, so they use the barcodes to double check their work.
Yeah, they ensure that the library only contains the precise programmed missense variants they intended to build.
And the scale of that library is just staggering. They successfully generated 9,790 missense variants.
It's massive.
That covers 90% of all possible amino acid substitutions across the entire AIR protein and 98% of the substitutions that can occur via a single nucleotide variant.
It's basically the whole map.
So once they delivered this massive library into the HEK293 cells, one variant per cell, they had a heterogeneous pool of glowing and dark cells. How did they physically separate them to read the results?
They leveraged fluorescence-activated cell sorting, or FACS.
FACS, okay.
Basically, they flow the entire population of cells through a laser in a single file stream.
Wow, single file.
Yeah, and the sorter isolates the top 10% most fluorescent cells, so those are the ones containing a highly functional AIR variant.
And then what?
They extract the DNA from that sorted population and use next-generation sequencing to count the barcodes.
The barcodes again.
Right, it becomes a straightforward mathematical ratio. If a specific variant's barcode is highly enriched in the fluorescent population compared to the unsorted baseline, that variant is functional.
And if it's depleted, the variant is deleterious.
Exactly.
So the first hurdle for any massive functional screen is validation. Did the map actually tell the truth?
And it did. The data showed it cleanly separated the known nonsense variants, the broken ones, from the synonymous variants, which are harmless.
It also tracked perfectly with the basic physical constraints of protein structure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Variants that altered amino acids buried deep within the protein's hydrophobic core were overwhelmingly deleterious.
Whereas substitutions on the solvent-exposed surface were largely tolerated.
Right, because the surface is more flexible. But the structural validation goes even deeper when you look at specific residues. The map demonstrated extreme intolerance whenever an amino acid was substituted with a proline.
A proline. What makes proline so special?
Well, proline is unique among the standard amino acids because its side chain binds back to the nitrogen of the peptide backbone, creating a cyclic structure.
Okay, so it loops back on itself?
Yeah, and this physically locks the phi angle of the peptide bond, introducing a rigid kink into the polypeptide chain.
So if you drop a proline into an alpha helix or a beta sheet where it doesn't belong,
the steric hindrance basically shatters the secondary structure of the protein.
That perfectly confirms the assay respects the biophysics of protein folding. It also validated known biology by showing zero tolerance for mutations within critical air domains, like the CARD, SAND, and PHE2 regions.
Right, those are well-established critical domains.
But the real value of a complete map is finding what we didn't previously know to look for.
Yeah.
They found two specific proline residues, proline 126 and proline 129, that were highly intolerant to any substitution.
Yes.
And these sit adjacent to the nuclear localization signal. What is the mechanical role of these specific residues?
So a nuclear localization signal, or NLS, is a short peptide sequence that acts as a binding interface for important proteins.
And importants are the transporters.
Exactly. They physically transport the air protein through the nuclear pore complex into the nucleus, where it has to act as a transcription factor.
Okay.
While the NLS itself is critical, its immediate flanking regions dictate how that signal is presented structurally. The extreme intolerance at Pro 126 and Pro 129 suggests those rigid proline kinks are mechanically required to expose the NLS.
Oh, wow. So if you mutate them to a flexible amino acid,
the NLS likely gets buried in the tertiary structure, the important can't bind, and the error protein is just stranded in the cytoplasm.
That is fascinating. The map also highlighted something a bit counterintuitive. I mean, we naturally associate autoimmune disease with a loss of air function.
Right.
But the data revealed 8 specific variants that caused a significant increase in reporter activation.
Yeah, these were gain-of-function variants.
And they clustered specifically where a mutation introduced a hydrophobic amino acid into an intrinsically disordered region of the protein. Why would a water-repelling amino acid in a floppy region cause the protein to become hyperactive?
So intrinsically disordered regions lack a fixed 3D structure. They are highly flexible and typically rich in hydrophilic or water-loving amino acids, so they can interact dynamically with the surrounding solvent.
Okay, that makes sense.
They often function as flexible tethers or transient binding sites for various transcriptional co-activators. When a mutation drops a bulky hydrophobic patch into one of these flexible regions, it changes the thermodynamics.
Because the hydrophobic patch desperately wants to avoid water.
Exactly. And that avoidance can drive spurious protein-protein interactions or artificially stabilize a conformation that is supposed to be transient.
So in error's case.
This might cause it to recruit the transcriptional machinery too aggressively, leading to the hyperactivation we see in the assay.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. If the thymus is running the security simulator in overdrive because of a hyperactive air protein, does that manifest as disease in a patient? Is it dangerous for you, or does it just make you extra immune?
It's a great question, and honestly, the physiological consequences of an error gain of function are still a biological frontier.
We don't fully know yet.
Right. Immune tolerance requires a really delicate temporal and spatial balance. If error is hyperactive, it could be forcing MTEX to express excessive tissue antigens, which might inappropriately trigger apoptosis in T cells that we actually need for normal immune defense.
Oh, so it could lead to immunodeficiency rather than autoimmunity.
Exactly. Alternatively, the altered transcriptional complex might mistakenly upregulate non-target genes. The current UK Biobank cohorts just didn't have enough statistical power regarding these specific gain-of-function variants to answer this definitively, but it fundamentally expands our mechanistic models of autoimmune biology.
So let's transition from the cellular mechanics to the clinical data. How does this glowing green cell map actually alter the landscape for patients carrying these mutations right now?
The clinical translation is immediate. By integrating this functional map with the ClinVar database, the researchers provided the functional evidence necessary to reclassify 133 variants.
That is a huge jump.
It really is. Crucially, they formally resolved 32% of all existing missense. VUS's 109 out of 345 variants were instantly categorized.
And the majority of these were downgraded to likely benign, providing immediate diagnostic closure for patients who are previously in that state of uncertainty.
Yeah, imagine waiting years and suddenly you have an answer.
Incredible. And to prove that a dark cell in the lab translates directly to a sick patient in the clinic, they analyzed an international cohort of 98 patients with confirmed APS1.
Right.
Since APS1 is autosomal recessive, patients carry 2 variants. How did the researchers synthesize the functional scores of 2 different mutations into a single clinical metric?
They developed something called the Combined Allele Map Score, or CAM score.
CAM score, okay.
Evaluating compound heterozygotes, where a patient has a different mutation on each allele, is like a classic bottleneck in medical genetics. Instead of relying on binary labels like pathogenic or benign, the CAM score provides a continuous quantitative variable.
So they take the functional activity score of allele A, as measured in the assay, and just combine it with the score of allele B.
Exactly. And when they plotted those CAM scores against the clinical records of the 98 patients, the correlation was striking.
The lower the CAM score, meaning more profound functional damage across both alleles, the higher the number of distinct autoimmune symptoms the patient suffered from.
Right. It establishes a quantitative linear relationship between the biochemical efficiency of the error protein in a petri dish and the severity of multi-organ autoimmunity in a human being.
They also extended this correlative power far beyond the rare disease cohort. Right?
Yeah, by tapping into the UK biobank.
Looking at exome sequencing and health records from nearly 500,000 individuals.
500,000, yeah.
Because EPS1 requires two compromised alleles, the critical question was whether carrying just one damaging missense variant, so a heterozygous state, confers a measurable phenotypic risk at a population scale.
And the population data is unequivocal. Operating under a dominant model, they found that heterozygous carriers of damaging error variants face substantial health impacts.
The stats on this are wild. These carriers exhibited 7.4 times higher odds of developing hypoparathyroidism and 1.8 times higher odds of presenting with vitamin B12 deficiency anemia.
It fundamentally redefines the carrier state for error mutations. We can no longer view heterozygous carriers as entirely asymptomatic.
A single compromised allele actively and significantly increases the baseline susceptibility to specific autoimmune and endocrine phenotypes.
Exactly. It highlights the immense statistical power of population-scale biobanks in teasing out dominant effects that are just invisible when studying small, rare disease cohorts.
But with any high-throughput assay, we have to interrogate the blind spots.
Of course.
The map proved highly accurate across almost the entire protein, but it systematically failed to accurately score known pathogenic mutations within one specific domain, which is PHD1.
Why did the assay miss the functional impact of this specific region?
The limitation stems directly from the epigenetic state of the reporter system.
Okay, walk me through that.
Well, inside a living cell, DNA is tightly schooled around histone proteins, forming chromatin. Chromatin exists in different spots of accessibility. The error protein heavily relies on its PHD1 domain to recognize and bind to unmethylated histone H3K4, which is a hallmark of tightly packed, repressed chromatin.
So it's basically locked up tight.
Exactly. The PHD1 domain essentially acts as an epigenetic pry bar, allowing error to anchor onto closed chromatin and recruit the machinery necessary to crack it open and transcribe the hidden tissue-restricted antigens.
Okay, so the limitation is a product of where they inserted the reporter gene in the HEK293 cells. The plasmid reporter system they engineered was already existing in an accessible open chromatin state. Precisely. Because the insulin GFP reporter was already in open chromatin, error didn't need its epigenetic pry bar to access the promoter.
Oh, I see.
It could bypass the requirement for the PHD1 domain entirely. Therefore, when researchers introduced mutations that utterly destroyed the PHD1 domain, the protein could still float over to the open insulin reporter, turn it on, and make the cell glow green.
So the assay falsely scored those severe mutations as functional because the specific biochemical task reliant on that domain just wasn't challenged by the experimental design.
Right, it is a brilliant example of how biological context dictates functional readout.
Knowing this, how does the field iterate on this methodology to capture those chromatin-dependent interactions? What are the next steps?
The natural progression is to move away from artificial exogenous reporter plasmids and transition to measuring the endogenous genome.
So using single-cell RNA sequencing.
Yeah, using single-cell RNA sequencing as a readout for massive parallel assays allows researchers to observe how each variant affects the transcription of thousands of natural target genes within their native chromatin context.
Which would capture the activity of domains like PHD1 that interface directly with the cell's native epigenetic landscape.
Exactly.
By systematically testing nearly 10,000 genetic variants before they ever appear in a clinic, scientists have created a proactive map that instantly diagnoses mysterious genetic mutations. This flips the script on genomics, allowing us to predict and interpret autoimmune disease risks without making patients wait years for answers.
It's a total paradigm shift.
What does this mean for the future of personalized medicine? When a simple DNA swab at birth might cross-reference a map of every possible human mutation, diagnosing your future before you even show a single symptom. This episode was based on an open access article under the BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, bass by bass.
Changes for